what I hope we walk away with today is a sense for how we, in our various roles, in our different congregational settings, how we can help create a culture of awareness and support for people who have experienced miscarriage, infertility, stillbirth, and other kinds of reproductive losses. My name is Elise, and I am currently in kind of a different role. I'm working with Lilly Endowment's National Initiative to Address Economic Challenges Facing Pastoral Leaders. So we have grants to organizations that represent about two-thirds of American Christian churches in the country, all of whom are doing work on how do we address the kind of systemic changes that are leading to the fact that it's really hard to make ends meet as pastors and ministers of various sorts. So that's kind of my day job. Prior to that, I was a United Methodist pastor. I served a church in South Carolina and did a large amount of freelance work while I was staying home with our children when they were smaller. During that time, while I was still in divinity school, I had the first of what would eventually be four early pregnancy losses. I was absolutely shocked by how painful it was. There's the narrative that we talked about on the panel yesterday, don't tell anyone until your second trimester, et cetera. What that sort of leads you to believe is that it's not such a big deal if you have a loss early. And I was really blown away by how strong my grief response was. And then when I looked for resources, there are more now than there were 10 years ago, but there wasn't much out there, which provided a feedback loop that said, you're right, this isn't a big deal. You're unique in thinking that this is an issue. I really struggled. I struggled to find a way to process it. I ended up doing an independent study with Teresa Berger, who is a wonderful scholar who's now up at Yale and was incredibly generous to work through that with me. And I did some of my theological processing that way. And I was also fortunate because Karen Westerfield Tucker, who had a significant pregnancy loss when she was serving as a chaplain at Notre Dame, was one of our worship professors at the time. And she had written and then advocated very strongly for a service of healing after miscarriage to be included in the United Methodist Book of Worship long ago. So she was another. I had wonderful mentors in that space. Fast forward a couple years, and I was serving a 2,100-member church in a smaller town in South Carolina, and I started getting referrals for pastoral care and counseling from women, both from our church and from other churches, who were struggling with pregnancy loss. And one of those experiences, it was a woman who had a loss maybe at 11 or 12 weeks and was voicing many of the things that I had found painful. And she was sitting in my office and she said, I went to Lifeway, because this is before everyone just looked on Amazon, right? We still had some Christian stores in the town. I went to Lifeway, I went to Family Christian, I went to Zondervan, and there was nothing. There were books on healing after abortion. There were books on infertility. There were books on marriage that's falling apart, nothing on miscarriage. Am I crazy? I must be overreacting. And so I was like, well, someone needs to do something about this. So I ended up writing a book, which ended up sending me into that space as a kind of specialized ministry. So what I'm going to talk about today is I'm going to talk about some ways that in that experimental ministry, I have observed or experienced this helping people. Here are some ways I've seen. And then we have a small enough group that actually we can probably do this as a whole. We're going to brainstorm some ways with you thinking about your specific contexts. What might be other ways to help create a culture in which women and partners who experience this kind of loss can know that their loss belongs in the worshiping life of the community of God, that it's not apart from it, that it's not so unimportant that it doesn't have a place. I want to start by doing two things, and I'm going to let you think about these questions while we're doing introductions, because they're slightly big, and I bet we've got some introverts in here too who might need a minute to process before talking. What's at stake with this for people who have these losses emotionally? What's at stake for people in your churches who have these losses theologically? And what is at stake pastorally? Okay? You don't have to have an answer for each of those, but let your brain start working on that in the background. What's at stake? Why does this matter? Why does it matter that our churches are places and communities where these kinds of losses are honored and have a way of being brought to God? Okay? The what's at stake question answers itself, right? Things like Mother's Day, right? Or Nativity, or go on and on and on, All Saints Day. These are regular liturgical experiences that we have that can be profoundly isolating and triggering for people who are carrying these silent burdens around. I'm going to pass out just a worksheet that this is the kind of conversation where we could talk for the rest of the afternoon. And I wish we could do that, but what we can do in this time is to sketch out the terrain a little bit, to talk about some resources, and hopefully I look forward to learning from your ideas as well as sharing some of the things that I've either seen or developed or experimented with over the years. The goal when we are, I think, looking at these things for church communities is not how many miscarriage or infertility or stillbirth things can we cram into the life of our congregation. That's the wrong question. I think the right question is, how do we create a culture of awareness and tenderness for mourning, and in these particular cases, a very specific kind of mourning? We are not great at this anyway, and our culture does not teach us to be good at sitting with or walking with people, especially in extended times of suffering. We are helped when we have rituals, like for a funeral. We know what to do when somebody dies, right? We have a committee and they make food, or we have a service at the church and people send flowers. There are ways that we know how to mark some kinds of losses. We are not as good at extended walking with people when they are in the valley, okay? And if people know that and sense that, and specifically people who are dealing with infertility loss and grief of different kinds, or reproductive loss and grief of different kinds, if there isn't an intentional openness, then these things stay silent because they need to be protected. They need to be protected. This is vulnerable territory. So I'm going to go through some ideas here, and some of these may be like, oh yeah, this is something that would fit really well with our church culture, and some of these may be like, ah, this wouldn't work at all, or it would be upsetting. You all know your space. These are suggested in the way that I might just sort of like try to spark creativity. So one of the pieces is immediate pastoral care at the time of a loss. Now, whether or not a woman or a partner will come to the pastor or the pastor will ever know about it depends largely on what kind of culture you've created, right? So, but if you have the kind of culture where, or if you have a relationship with the pastor, right, usually it's the kind of people who would go to see their pastor are people with an existing relationship in that space and some trust on board already. So is your pastoral care staff, your pastor, are they aware of the complexity of this kind of loss? Do they understand that women show up in intake situations with psychotic breaks or with major depressive episodes on anniversaries of miscarriages without knowing why they're presenting? This is traumatic loss if it is not processed well, okay? And again, otherwise really good pastors can make very damaging responses if they have not thought through these things ahead of time. Well, I mean, I'm not sure if anyone else would say this, but when I did this book, I interviewed several women to try to get not just my story, but to have this be a thicker thing that more people could find themselves in. And one woman went to a pastor she really liked, and he said, oh, did it happen because you had an abortion ever? Did you ever have an abortion? So even just ignorance about why pregnancy loss happens, yeah. I mean, really, you can't think of a worse response that is both blaming whether she had or not. There was no good way that was going to go. Some pastors are just uncomfortable, and so it's a minimizing response. It's like, oh, I'm sorry, I'll pray for you, pat, pat, and then move on. You know, how's your weekend going to be? That kind of thing. Sometimes there can be a kind of, and I was really grateful. There was a CRCNA Reformed Church pastor in the session yesterday who brought up the fact that sometimes Reform theology becomes an excuse for pastoral malpractice if it's not entered into richly and well. So you want to find an answer. Here's what God was doing here, right? Oh, this happened because God has a plan. And there are some responses that are very common that women get that don't tend to come from pastoral staff but could come from church members, like, well, God just needed another little angel in heaven, which you think, like, how, but maybe that was the only comforting thing that person could think of 20 years ago when she had a pregnancy loss, right? So we don't know where people's nonsense is coming from, and we don't want to vilify people who say things like this. At the same time, these comments do damage. And if someone isn't prepared and doesn't understand the complexity of this kind of grief, then unintentional minimization, I would say, is the primary pastoral problem. Do church members think to let your pastor or pastoral care staff know when a loss has occurred? This was always an issue. And I think in large or small membership churches, in smaller membership churches, people assume the pastor knows everything, assumes they're omniscient. In large membership churches, people assume there's a system for letting the pastor know every time something happens. Again, this is culture creation, right? We ask permission. Is it okay if I let the pastor know that you're, and then?
And it used to be there was a system because somebody at the hospital would know the pastor and call them.
Right. Which is HIPAA, exactly, exactly.
That's used to be how.
Yep, that's right. This can be a really good time to have on-hand resources to hand to somebody. Now, make sure they're not terrible books. And the other thing is, sometimes a book can work really well for one person and be brutal for someone else, right? Yes, exactly.
Right,
right, right. And so the thing that's so helpful about this is the first move with these things is always sensitivity and listening. It's always accompanying, right? Where do you find yourself? What would help? And if you don't know what would help, how can I be with you? Going in to any sacred space, humble and curious, before we have answers. And that's really helpful, because what you don't want to do is have your resource be your substitute for care and accompaniment.
Yeah.
right? It's not something where you can be like, since I gave you this pamphlet that we made in our church or this care notes copy or this book, then I don't have to walk with you. Women vary in terms of when they're ready. For some, they don't want to talk to somebody at the beginning, and a book or a care notes copy or a pamphlet can be the thing that lets them say, oh, this is something my church cares about. I'll pick this up when I'm ready. And for some women, what they need is presence, right? So again, this requires sensitivity, listening to the Holy Spirit, as you said, Kathy. But like any kind of pastoral care, it's a willingness to walk into a sacred space and be attentive to the leadership of the Holy Spirit. And listen to the person, because that's where you can tell where the Holy Spirit is working and what they're doing. I've got a list up here, and I want to just sort of, at the time, okay, this is the resource I have, and it's set up so that you're supposed to be able to work through it chronologically or however. It's supposed to be validating, and then there's a bunch of resources. There are worship templates. There are prayer services. There are example sermons in the back. So that's what that is. This, by Jenny Schrodel, is by an Orthodox pastor's wife, presbytera, and it was the best resource that I found at the time that was specifically Christian. She spends a lot of time on infant death and stillbirth, okay? So that's the thing to know about that resource. So if you have someone who's suffering from infertility or earlier pregnancy loss, this is not as good of a choice, but it's excellent for stillbirth and infant death. Kate Williams, who is here at this event, has just had something released through GIA, which I would imagine might be up at their resource table. Yeah, it's called Of Womb and Tomb, and it is a combination of like five different people's narrative stories with liturgical templates, practices for responding in these situations. And then a friend of mine from Divinity School recently released a book called Birthed. And I have to say that I haven't read it. And so I can't say it's the best thing or worst thing ever. But it is a thoughtful, I know it is a thoughtful treatment of infertility for from a Christian perspective. So those would be things that you could look at and check out and see, are these helpful? Do we want to have a couple of copies of one of these at the church so that we can be useful?
What is the name of yours?
Mine is called What Was Lost, and you are welcome to take a look at it if you want, but no pressure. I don't want this to be...
I actually was hungering for something more when I was registering for these workshops, and I found the name of this workshop in your book title, and ordered a copy of it, and found it, really helpful for me, even if it was months delayed, but still, good. I appreciate just going through space of remembering, allowing yourself to remember instead of just seeking to, push and move on. The resources in the back I found really helpful.
Oh, good.
We don't have that in the church. And even the idea of doing an annual service for families and women who have lost, I think, is a beautiful thing that is missing. So thank you for that.
As you were saying, and I think there are some parts of the broader Christian church that have practices for this because they maybe have different ways of having the conversation about pregnancy and in general. But I think these are ways, if your church has an annual worship service, even if three people come, what you're saying to the church is this matters to us. Mm-hmm. This is a real part of the Christian community where we baptize babies and we bury bodies of people we have loved. And sometimes there is this space where we lose or cannot receive what we believe we've been promised. All these things, these are part of the life of the church. They're part of the worshiping life of the community. So communal support at the time of a loss, there may be someone in the church, and really the people who would be best at this are people who have been bereaved at some point themselves, I think would be the most sensitive people. And you might want to not let just anyone join this group. But if there's a group that feels called to this, who could reach out and journey with women, I've known some women who've had losses, and Kathy, as you were saying, it carves out a space in you to be able to sit with someone else's loss without trying to shove them toward healing it, right? If there are people gifted with that spiritual gift in your congregation, this could be an amazing way for them to use that gift. With permission included on prayer lists. Now, not without permission, right? Because again, this is sensitive, and this is one of those spaces where outing someone could do a lot of damage, but invite them. Sometimes we put people who are struggling to conceive on this list. Sometimes we put people who've had a loss like this on this list. It's part of our culture. You decide if that's right for you or not, but this is something we recognize. Education or reflection or peer support groups, this can take a lot of different forms, but I really think this is one of the places where I've seen the most hopeful healing outcomes. When you offer something like this in a church context, I would imagine that the same is true at a hospital or a counseling center. You get a very small group response, right? Because only a few people at any given time are ready to do this kind of processing and have enough of a felt need that they're able to acknowledge that they can overcome the barriers of time and embarrassment, and I'm bringing this really vulnerable part of my life into a group of people I don't know, etc. But for the people who are ready and need it, it is incredibly powerful. I just facilitated a four-week group at my church, and we use that book just because the reflection questions mean that you can give them some opportunities to start journaling about it if they want to, or and again, everything has to be invitational and not didactic, but at the same time, here is a way you can process this. That invitation can sometimes really help people. The women in the class, I had one who was early in a pregnancy after a very painful loss. I had one who had a loss after two living children and was so angry at God that she had not come to church for 6 months and was and had been very, very involved. Like, her mom is, and she just quit. She was just like, screw you, God. And I mean, this is a very honest, and especially when you look at our scriptures, a very honest response. I think there's a lot more to be said for the honesty of that kind of relationship with God than someone who just stuffs it and keeps. But sometimes you have to stuff and keep, especially if you're in a leadership position, right? These things are really complex. And then there was a woman who had had two children that are grown now, who had had a loss 20 years ago. And there was a woman who had had one successful pregnancy that had ended in a 5-month miscarriage about 25 years before and had never been able to bear children. And then there was a bereaved grandmother whose daughter had had a miscarriage, and she wondered, could I have done something different, and had her own grief that she was not paying as much attention to because she was so focused on trying to help her daughter. So it was an interesting combination, right? And they did more to heal each other in that time. The woman who had had the loss and then had never been able to have children had not come to church on a Mother's Day or a Christmas for the rest of her 25 years of church membership because it was too painful for her. I asked them afterwards, I said, what should I tell people at this workshop? You know, what was helpful? What was not helpful? What should I change? And we did these 4 weeks where, again, part of trauma healing is telling the story of what happened to you again and having it validated this time. So we did a lot of story sharing, both in their homework and then in the group. We talked about God. Like, that's the middle third of that book is meant to sort of at least open a place to be in relationship with God with these very hard questions. Where were you? You're dropping stitches, you know? There are all of these, and do you care about this life that I lost? Is this your child? What's the relationship to baptism, et cetera, et cetera? If you Google this one of the most Googled questions is, do miscarried babies go to heaven? And again, this is theologically crucial for what we're doing in the church. We have a narrative for baptized babies. We have a narrative for funerals. We have a narrative of absence when it comes to, in many cases, when it comes to how we understand these lives that are lost before they are born or before there is a body to care for afterwards. But we close with a worship session, very simple. I like to use, I have found over time that using something concrete is very helpful. One of the struggles with these kinds of losses is that you don't have a memorial book that people signed. You don't have, you can't purchase a coffin. You don't have a bulletin afterwards. There's nothing to kind of hold that says this life was a life and it was part of. So providing an opportunity for some sort of physical thing. At my church in Florence, I made an arrangement and we did biannual services. And I got these, I found this garden sculpture that was the hand, like hands like this. And I used the Isaiah passage about our names being written on God's hands and how God can never forget us, and it's wonderful imagery because it's even a mother may forget her child, but I will never forget you. And I let the people who are part of that, invited them to think of a name for the child they'd lost, and to write that name on the sculpture. And then that sculpture was put in the columbarium. We had an outdoor columbarium there. So again, not the same as, but in the space where we acknowledge that that a life has been lost and now belongs to God. And then I would also do like stones, and so they could write the name twice. They could write it once on the thing that was left in the church as a permanent remembrance, and then they could write the name on a stone to take home. I know Kate likes to use candles, and I did that in the last service here. Something about the life that was lost is still bringing light. There is meaning to this life that was lost, and it is going to change us. There is meaning in that, meaning making of the life. So anyway, these women, a couple of them wrote back and said, the last worship session was wonderful by giving me a sense of peace and the ability for some kind of closure. That was the one who lost a pregnancy 20 years ago. And then the other one I mentioned, even after more than 20 years, I found the entire course and being in the workshop with others that had lost babies in utero a spiritually healing exercise. What happens in these spaces? Telling the story so the trauma is processed, right? And none of these things happen in full ways, but they work toward it. Validation. Oh, I'm not crazy. This is a real, legitimate grief that tears people apart, and I'm not the only one. So this isn't me being overreactive. This is me experiencing something that the body of Christ experiences, that other people experience. And finding a way to say, to try to open the relationship with God to whatever is there. The younger woman who wasn't going to church didn't go because she didn't feel like she could say any of the things with integrity anymore. She was just like, I'm not sure I believe this anymore. And if God does exist, then I hate God because of what has been. Why didn't God save my baby, right? These are the normal, really kind of healthy responses within an intimate relationship with God. And if those things don't have space to be honored and worked through, so this provides a kind of, these small groups can provide a kind of opportunity for that. Outreach, I had a couple of really excellent pastors in South Carolina who are friends, are like, 1 in 4 pregnancies ends in miscarriage. This is an outreach opportunity. And I think they meant it like, oh, people are hurting and we can throw our arms wide. And there's so many of them out there who will just come to be healed by Jesus. And So we experimented with that in some different contexts. And I would come in and I would do guest preaching in the morning at the Sunday services. And we would announce that that evening I'd be doing this special community service for whatever. And I did that in different configurations, sometimes just miscarriage, stillbirth, sometimes infertility and other kinds of reproductive loss. And again, you are never going to get 3,000 people from your community like rushing to knock down these doors. But what is accomplished there? In your main worship service, you say, we think this is important enough to have a special service about it. And we think it's important enough to put resources toward it. And we are inviting you to be part of that. So in 6 months, when your person who was really sitting there excited because they just found out they're pregnant has a tremendous loss, they think of the church as a place where these conversations are welcome, right? This is patient, long-term work. Again, something Kate shared that she's doing is working with local hospitals. I think that Catholic hospitals are, in my experience, more open to this kind of explicit work than other hospitals can be. But I think that if you have medical professionals in your church, what is true is that there are a lot of OBGYNs, nurse practitioners, nurses, pastoral counselors, hospital chaplains who run into these losses frequently, have a very limited amount of time to engage with the person having the loss and would love to have some sort of way. And so maybe that's just asking them, what could you use? Could we help provide a resource for this? Whether it is whether it's a brochure that says, this is really, really hard. Grieving is normal. Here is a hotline number, and here is a counseling practice in town that works well with this kind of thing. If it's that simple, but if you can partner with the hospital to offer that, that can be a gift as well. I want to give you guys a chance to talk too, so we're just going to stop. You can read the rest of those. But I think, again, I would just say, and just say again, thanks to Amy for reminding us, there's no one-size-fits-all package to do this. And awareness and sensitivity and bringing this part of what is a very common loss into the life of the worshiping community really can make a difference for people. And then maybe your church members won't be the ones showing up on the doorstep of the counseling center having hallucinations because of the traumatic miscarriage they had a year ago. So